Welcome to the Pacific Naval War Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Hammond. Today is January the 13th, 2022, and I'd like to thank you for joining me today. December 7th, 1941, the day that President Roosevelt said in his speech before Congress, a day that would live in infamy, and it most certainly has so far. As we have just completed a little over a month ago. And it is a day for Americans that will live in infamy. The day that the United States entered the war, World War II. But December 7th, 1941, history treats that day as the day that the United States got into the war, and some historians treat it as the day that Japan took revenge, forced revenge against the United States for the freezing of assets, for embargoes, steel embargoes, oil embargoes, so forth and so on. But the fact of the matter is, when you study World War II, you can't study World War II from December 7th, 1941, till the end of the war. You have to back up, and I don't mean just 1 year. I don't mean 2 years. You have to back up and back up decades. On December the 10th, 1898, the United States signed a treaty with Spain in Paris, France, called the Paris Peace Treaty, And as a result of that treaty, Spain agreed to sell the Philippine Islands to the United States for $20 million. As a result of that treaty, the United States acquired Guam. As a result of that treaty, the United States acquired Puerto Rico. Now, when you look at that treaty, you look at that war, the War of 1898, what was going on in the Western Pacific was a unique situation. That time period was the groundwork for what would become World War II. And that's a broad statement made on a broad period, and I understand that. But what I'm saying is that in 1898, Japan occupied a good part of China. Japan occupied parts of Mongolia, Manchuria, and was in the process of mining, running mining operations, iron ore. They were fracking. There was a lot of mining operations that were going on that were supplying the Japanese Empire in 1898. Now, as a result, when you look at the situation in the Philippines and Spain, well, to put it mildly, they weren't getting along very well. And when the United States acquired the Philippines from Spain, which was a huge problem for Spain, so as a result of the Treaty of Paris, Spain might have been saying, we do not mind moving the Philippines, let the Americans deal with it. And so the Americans were willing to deal with it. Well, the rebellion that was going on in the Philippines became an American problem. Now, at the same time, relations between the key players at the time that the United States became a key player, England was a key player, Japan obviously was a key player, Russia was a key player, and when you factor in Southeast Asia, France was a key player. Now, as a result, the politics of this time period was very, very complicated, very, very intense. Almost like a bowl of spaghetti. It was just interwoven as it sat on that plate. So, you had France, who was allies with Russia. You had England and Japan sign a treaty in 1902. And in that treaty, there was a key, there were some key phrases as it related to war. Now, if Japan went to war with one country, or if the UK went to war with one country, the other, either Japan or the UK, would not be involved. But they if they went to war with two or more, then the other signature in that treaty would join in. So, you had a war that started in 1904 between the Japanese and the Russians. And it started on February the 8th, 1904, and it would not end until the treaty was signed in Portsmouth on September the 5th, 1905. But the battle that ended that war was the Battle of Tsushima, and that was on the 27th and 28th of May, 1905. And it was at that point that the Russians realized that they could not stop or in any way impede the Japanese Empire. So both sides were willing to go to the peace table, and the treaty was signed. Now, Russia was out of the war. It was Japan against Russia, with the UK being neutral. So with Russia now out of the way for the Japanese Empire in 1905, in the fall of 1905, the remaining threat to the Japanese Empire, viewed from the position of the Japanese Empire, was the United States. And as a result of that view, that peace treaty, that contract that they signed with the United Kingdom, still played. Because if from the viewpoint of the Japanese, if the United States were to move against parts of China, or if the United States were to move against Japan, then the UK would have to remain out of it. Now, had the United States teamed up with Russia in 1904 and attacked Japan, that would have pulled the UK into the war and put the UK against the United States. But the United States wasn't involved in the war, and it was Russia against Japan. So when you look at that time period, there's tension. And at some point, when you look at it and you see it, and you read about it, and you study it, and you break it down, and you study it deeper and deeper and deeper, you come to a conclusion that in this time period, in the state that the United States was in 1905, in the state the United States Navy was in regards to the Pacific in 1905, you can very easily come to the conclusion that maybe the United States should not have been involved in this war. because the Philippines and Taiwan, there was going to be tension here. And the United States did not have the Navy at the time to support that sort of diplomacy, that level of diplomacy, that far away from the California coast. So this tension would move along. Now, as things transpired, looking at the timeline, Spain would sign a treaty with Germany and sell Germany these possessions, these remaining colonial possessions that they had, islands, and Germany bought those from Japan. Well, as soon as World War II started, and here again the treaty, but as soon as World War II started, and this treaty would last for almost two decades, not quite, Japan sided with the Allied forces in World War I. They sided with the UK, and the reason why they sided with them in large part was they could immediately move against Germany and take those islands. So Germany grabbed the, or excuse me, Japan grabbed those islands from Germany and held on to those islands till the end of the war. Now what usually happens is at the end of the war you give back, war's over, you give back those possessions. But Japan held on to them. So it went through the League of Nations, and the League of Nations said, no, Japan can hold on to them. That can become Japanese territory. And it did. And history remembers these islands as the Mandate Islands. And this would play a significant part in the decades leading up to World War II. Now, what this did was it proceeded to impose additional barrier islands between the Philippines, between Japan. And when you look at Japan and you look at their island barriers, the furthest island Japan possessed, the most eastern island, was the Bonin Island. They had the Ryukyu Islands that were to the south. And it continued to add. And so Japan played one end against the other. The Japanese Empire played one end against the other in order to work their way towards their national objective or their national intent. So, comes time for 1922, and the Washington Naval Treaty. Now, as a result of the Washington Naval Treaty, now let me back up just for a moment. And you got to remember, too, that through this time period, from 1898, as we go through the timeline, 1898, 1904, 1905, as we proceed, 1910, as time keeps moving forward, the capital ship in world navies was the battleship. So you move from the pre-dreadnoughts to the dreadnoughts, and these ships, these doctrines, in every time a nation would come out with a new and improved battleship, that doctrine of that battleship would force other navies to say, okay, we need to scrap these battleships because the United States has this battleship, or because Great Britain has this battleship. It was a constant series of one-upmanship to where nations had to keep up with what was going on in the world. Because, I mean, if somebody had come out with, I'll use an extreme example, if somebody had come out with the U.S. had come out with the USS Missouri or the USS New Jersey, if that ship had come out in 1916, then what would the navies have done? Because now you're talking about a fast battleship that could literally run circles around these slower ships. So you were constantly pushing and trying to keep up, trying to get a step ahead, looking over your shoulder because somebody was coming up behind you. And you got to remember what the objective of the Navy is, whether we're talking about 1898 or 1941 or the current date. The objective of the Navy is to keep the sea lanes open for commerce, for shipping. And in certain days and times, and to a lesser degree today, that included piracy. But it was to keep these lanes open for commerce. They just weren't weapons of war, but they possessed the innate function of a weapon of war, or a weapon for war. And so as we move through, we go into World War One, and we come out of World War One, and now we're knocking on the door of the Washington Naval Treaty. It comes time, nations were ready for this, because it basically put a cap on spending. The United Kingdom had a total weight limit for battleships. By this time, the aircraft carrier had worked its way in, but was still fundamentally in the developmental stage. Everybody was still experimenting. Japan had built a training aircraft carrier from the keel up. Great Britain had converted a cruise liner. The United States had converted a collier. And that became the USS Langley. So when you look at what nations were doing, they were trying to figure out the aircraft carrier, knowing they had the backbone, knowing they had the steel wall of the battleship. But here was a chance to get a leg up with the aircraft carrier and further develop that as a weapon. And you're combining two doctrines, the doctrine of the ship and the doctrine of the aircraft, and you're combining those two into one doctrine, always maintaining the Carl von Clausewitz element of surprise. And with that great power of surprise comes the aircraft carrier. Because that ship, to get into a position, launch its planes under the cover of darkness, strike its target at sunrise, those planes can disappear and be picked up in a position other than where the ships were when they took off. And herein lies the advantage, not to mention the fact that you have pilots. So these are man-controlled, piloted weapons that have the ability to make adjustments once they are in the combat zone. Once they are in the area, they can pull off of one target and hit another target. Whereas once that shell leaves the barrel of that 12th, 14th, 16th, or in the case of the Musashi or the Yamato, at 18.1 inch gun. So once it left, it was going to where it was aimed. So once that began to happen, here was the war that was going to be on December 7th, 1941. Now all of a sudden, the Washington Naval Treaty was agreed upon and signed on February the 6th, 1922. So 19 years later, it's a little over 19 years later, the three key signers of this agreement, the United States, Great Britain, and the Japanese Empire, would be at war. And the key function, or the key weapon in that war, was going to be the aircraft carrier. So it was a developmental process, but in 1922, it was not an easy task. I mean, when the biplanes, when these prop planes landed on the deck of the USS Langley, at the very beginning, they didn't have the cable, they didn't have the arresting gear, they didn't have the hook on the back of the plane. That was part of the developmental. They had men out there when that pilot, just as he landed and was rolling forward, he cut the engine and there were men there to catch the wing. And so it was a process of, this will work, that won't work. We've tried this, we've tried that. And how do we, you know, the USS Langley for the U.S. Navy was a training vessel. It not only trained naval officers to become pilots, but it also trained naval officers on the function, the operation of an aircraft carrier. And so in this process, nations, the U.K., the Japanese Empire, the United States, were developing their own carrier-based air power doctrines that would come into play on December 7th, 1941. So, as it progressed, the treaty progressed, and it moved from Washington, D.C. in 1922 to London. And from there, it was putting caps on not just the battleships, but submarines, destroyers. I mean, they worked their way through. But the key to capital ships, and I'm a little bit ahead in making that statement, the two key ships was the battleship and the aircraft carrier. Now, it was in the early 30s that in the United States, with President Roosevelt as president and a Democrat, and the Democratic Party controlling both the House and the Senate, that the United States began to move into we've got to do something about our Navy. Not just our Navy in the Pacific, but our Navy in the Atlantic. So, the way the spending bills are progressed, they start in the House, they get passed in the House, moved to the Senate to be ratified. Any changes, it goes back to the House. Now, in that process, there was a representative from the state of Georgia, and he has a ship named after him, Carl Vinson. But he was instrumental in developing the Navy in general, specifically the Pacific Navy as well as the Atlantic Navy. Because when you look at those two navies, and you have to look at them separately, because the threat to the United States in the Atlantic differed from the threat to the United States in the Pacific, the need for certain ships, certain equipment, certain development of weapons, differed between the two. And so one of them was the Two Oceans Navy Act. And it was that development in that process throughout the 1930s. You know, a lot has been said, and I've heard it, I've read it, that the attack on Pearl Harbor caught the United States unprepared for World War II. Well, to a degree, there's a very little light in the truth of that statement, and that is, it caught the United States by surprise. But the fact of the matter is that the United States began preparing for World War II in the early 30s. Once Japan dropped out of that Washington Naval Treaty, which became the London Naval Treaty. And so once that happened, it was, we're moving towards war. Now it's only a matter of when. So we better get things moving so that we are prepared. And that's what happened. Now, and one of the things the United States did that was absolutely brilliant was they created a commercial shipping program. And in that program, these ships were built, contracted and built, and were to be used for commercial use. And this is how the United States worked around these limits, weight limits that were put on, and there was, on the weight limits too, there was a debate over what was a ton. Now in the United States, a ton is 2,000 pounds. Well, that's not the definition of a ton in the UK or Japan. So that ratio of 5 to 5 to 3, it came from the Washington Treaty. The United States had 5, Great Britain had 5, Japan had 3. Yeah, there was a lot of belief, and there's still a belief today, that treaty was unfair to the Japanese Empire. Well, that treaty actually favored the Japanese Empire, because it was the United States and Great Britain that would have to divide that ratio of 5 to 5 to 3 between two or more oceans. Great Britain had more to cover than the United States. The United States had the Atlantic and the Pacific, two coasts, the West Coast and the East Coast, not to mention the Gulf of Mexico. So it took the United States dividing that 5 out of that ratio and spreading those ships out, whereas in the UK they had even more. They had the Indian Ocean, the Atlantic, they had the Mediterranean. I mean, and the list goes on and on and on, not to mention the Pacific. So the UK was divided and divvied up even further, whereas the Japanese Empire could take their 3 and concentrate it. And that's what they did. And that's what anybody would do in their situation. So that gave them a greater concentration in the Western Pacific than the United States could afford to spend in the Western Pacific, than Great Britain could afford to spend in the Western Pacific. So when you look at that ratio, let there be no doubt that Japan came out of that treaty with the sun shining and the birds singing. The United States and Great Britain came out of that treaty with a little bit of cloud hiding the sun. And it was not necessarily something to jump up and down about. But it also put a cap on the spending, so no one country could run away with the naval arms buildup. And you would have that without that treaty, without that cap. And that's what all of these nations that participated, you had France, you had Italy, and the list goes on. But it was that cap, in this case a weight cap, a total tonnage. And you're talking about ships that weighed 48,000, 45,000, 48,000, 49,000 pounds in World War II. Or excuse me, 48,000 tons. A slip of my tongue. But it was the point that there was a buildup towards war. So that when, and I haven't even gotten into the intercepting of codes and the deciphering of codes, or in the Atlantic, the Enigma machines. It was a process that took years and years and years for the countries that ended up in the war, for those countries to actually go through to get to that war. So, with that, I'm going to stop right there. I appreciate you joining me. Thanks again for joining me, and we'll talk to you later.